Good morning, everyone. I wanted to start off with, I guess you could say, an apology. Just like you all probably needed a break, sometimes we instructors need a break as well. So I did not get much work done over the long weekend. So I will be getting your exams back on Thursday for this week. I know it seems a little out of order to do so, but I wanted to go ahead and go over the answers just because you're going to be having the same type of questions when the final comes up at the end of the quarter. And we have a quiz on Thursday, which means that there's a good chunk of the class, the lecture, that's going to be taken up by that quiz. So I thought, let me go ahead and go over the answers today, particularly because we're already quite ahead of where we're supposed to be in the syllabus. So I'll read out the questions, just because you might not remember what they were, of course. I might end up turning this into another answer key like I did last time, just so you have that available to study. But let me at least go over the answers for now. The first question was another run through Lewis dot structures. So you were supposed to come up with the Lewis dot structures, but again, you were not responsible for coming up with formal charge, even though we've talked about it again recently because we talked about redox reactions. So the first example was nitrite, which I think we had done in class somewhat recently. So from the quiz, I know that one of the mistakes that was happening was counting up the wrong number of valence electrons. So hopefully with practice, you all have figured out that it's based off the position of the periodic table where the elements are located. And it's not the atomic numbers themselves, but it's which column of the periodic table, because that tells us how many valence electrons that we have. So since we have one nitrogen and two oxygens, that nitrogen has 5 valence electrons, where oxygen has 6. But then there's also the fact that the molecule is charged. And since it's negatively charged, that means we've got 1 extra electron. So if you add that all together, that means there's 18 electrons total. Just as I'd done before, I underlined what the central atom was, which in this problem, all of the molecules followed the normal pattern, where the first atom listed is the one that was the central atom. So we have nitrogen in the middle, and then we have the 2 oxygens surrounding it. That only uses up 4 of the electrons, so we are able to put 12 more around just the oxygens, but then that only uses a total of 16 up. So oxygen can't violate the octet rule by having more than 16 or more than 8 electrons, and so the other 2 electrons would then have to go around the nitrogen. Now, I just had said that you don't need to know formal charge for these structures, but if you did it, you would find out that each of the oxygens has a negative charge, but the nitrogen has a positive charge. So that means we got charge separation going on. Even if you didn't analyze it like that, you could see that nitrogen lacks an octet. So one oxygen or the other, we can bring a pair of electrons in to complete the octet around the nitrogen. And so this would be a better structure for nitrite. If you did do formal charges, then it turns out that the nitrogen has no formal charge, the double bonded oxygen has no formal charge. The other oxygen would have a single negative charge, which makes sense because nitrite does overall have a negative charge. As I'm going through these answers, if there's anything that you all wanted to talk about more, don't be afraid to stop me because we've got plenty of time today in lecture. The second problem was carbonate, CO3-2. So counting up the number of electrons, we had the 1 carbon, we've got 3 oxygens, and then we do have a charge again. So carbon would have 4 valence electrons, each oxygen 6, and now we've got 2 extra electrons from the fact that it's charged. So adding all together, we get 24 electrons. So carbon is again in the center. And then automatically we'll go ahead and fill the other oxygens up. And if you add all the electrons that I've put around it, that does add up to 24. Because with the bond, each oxygen has 8 electrons, so 3 oxygens times 8 gives us the 24 electrons total we're supposed to have. Now, we still lack an octet, just like in the previous problem. So just like the previous problem, we'll move a pair of electrons in between oxygen and carbon for one of the oxygens. We can't do more than that because that will give us an octet around the carbon. So this structure with one double bond is the best structure for the molecule. If you looked at formal charges, the two single bonded oxygens would have a single negative charge. So two of those means we get the negative two that carbonate's supposed to be. Then the last problem was silicon dioxide, which is the silicon equivalent of carbon dioxide. Carbon and silicon, they're in the same column, so they're going to have similar behavior to each other. So one silicon and two oxygens, and this time we don't have any extra charge, so it's just the valence electrons from the atoms themselves. Silicon, since it's in the same column as carbon, would have 4 valence electrons. Each of the oxygens would have 6, and so that gives us 16 electrons total. So if we did just the single bonds, that uses up 4 electrons, which means we've got which means we've got 12 left over. So I could put 6 more around each of the oxygens, and that would give me my total of 16. Now, this time, silicon really lacks an octet because it's only got 4 electrons total. So if I take one pair of electrons from each oxygen this time and move them in, then we get something that looks just like carbon dioxide. It just happens to be silicon in the middle. And if you did look at formal charges, well, if you did it this way, none of the atoms have formal charges, so everything's neutral, which is the way the molecule's supposed to be. So anyone have any questions over the Lewis dot structures? Okay, then moving on. The second question was to explain what causes permanent dipoles to form versus temporary dipoles to form. So this is a little bit different flavor of the question than maybe what I've asked in the past. So permanent dipoles those are caused, the simplest way to say it, is by molecular structure. So previously on the quiz, you had had a question about CF4, which is a version of methane where the hydrogens have been replaced by fluorine. And you had that molecule compared to water. And the point was that for one of the molecules, the CF4, it ended up being nonpolar because it's tetrahedral. Water ended up being polar because it's not. And that's exactly right there what causes a permanent dipole to form. It's whether there's something in the structure of the molecule itself that causes it to end up being polar. Temporary dipoles there are two ways that that could be caused, and if you got either one of them, that was good enough. One of those ways is if you have a polar molecule approach a nonpolar molecule. So if you've got one molecule that's already got a plus or minus charge on it, if it comes near to another molecule, then let's say that it's the negative charge that's approaching. then that negative charged molecule that's approaching would pull positive charge to the surface of the nonpolar molecule. Or maybe the better way to say it is it would push the negative charge away. So that means on that molecule that may not have a permanent dipole, you temporarily have one that appears because it's interacting with something else. That's one way for it to happen. Another way is just from the motion of a molecule by itself. So again, thinking back to the previous quiz, you had a question about iodine. Iodine is a solid at room temperature, even though it is a completely nonpolar molecule. And the question was at that time was, well, why is something like iodine able to be a solid if it doesn't have any polarity to it? And it's because iodine is a large molecule. It has atoms that are large. And just in the molecules moving around, there's temporary charges that get formed due to its size. That's also the main way that fat molecules end up being attracted to each other. Just due to their large size, they have these temporary charges that form, and not necessarily even interacting with other molecules. So that's what I mean here by molecular motion, that sometimes just in the way the molecule moves around, these temporary charges can be developed. So that temporary charge is what causes the temporary dipoles. So permanent dipoles are due to the structure of the molecules themselves. Temporary dipoles, two sources, interacting with other molecules or just in the motion of the molecule itself. Now, next question is the one that might have been the most tedious on the exam because it had to relate to the atomic mass unit. So we had talked about the atomic mass unit in the past. And we had discussed how that atomic mass unit is defined based off of carbon. So the atomic mass unit is 1/12 the mass of a carbon-12 atom. And I still need to look up what is the reason why carbon was chosen for that. Once you have the AMU defined, then that automatically gets us the definition of the mole. Because one mole worth of AMUs is equal to 1 gram. So once you have the value for what an AMU is, you just divide that into a gram, and it's automatically going to give you the number for a mole, which is that 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd that you've seen in the text before. So the question asked, how is the atomic mass unit defined? And explain how this definition in turn is related to the concept of the mole. So the definition itself is that it's 1/12 the mass of a carbon-12 atom. And then the other definition is that one mole worth of AMUs gives you 1 gram. So just rearranging, like I said, to divide 1 gram by an AMU, that will give you the number for a mole. So next problem. Said, imagine a flask contains 30 milliliters of a 0.80 molar aqueous solution of sodium bicarbonate. And I know I had some people ask during the exam whether I meant mole or molar, and molar was what I meant. I'm worried that you might have gotten thrown off by me writing out in word form instead of symbol form. So molar is what's represented by capital M, and that is concentration in terms of molarity. So you have a 0.80 molar solution of sodium bicarbonate. You are asked to calculate how many grams of sodium bicarbonate would have been dissolved in the solution. So if you can remember what the definition of molarity is, molarity is defined as the moles of solute over the liters of solution. So you're given the molarity, you're given the volume of the solution. All you need to solve for then to work the problem is to figure out how many moles. The only hitch with that, of course, is that I gave the volume in milliliters, where you had to remember the molarity is defined in terms of liters. So we rearrange that equation, N, which is used to represent moles, is equal to the concentration, the molarity, times the volume. So the molarity in this case was 0.80 molar, and the volume was 0.030 liters. So multiplying that out, we get, if we keep, which I didn't grade for sig figs, but if we worried about sig figs, I'm multiplying something with two sig figs against something with three. So in that case, we're only going to keep the two sig figs. So I'm going to end up with 0.024 moles. And that's 0.024 moles of sodium bicarbonate. So since the question asked how many grams of sodium bicarbonate would have been dissolved, then we need to convert from moles to grams, which means we need the molar mass. So the molar mass is equal to 1 times sodium plus 1 times hydrogen plus 1 times carbon plus 3 times oxygen. So sodium is 22.98, I believe. Let me just double check. So 28.99 if we round. Okay. So 28.99.
Sorry.
22.99. Thank you. Hydrogen is 1.01. Carbon is 12.01. Oh, and I wrote in 16 instead of oxygen there. So that's 3 times 16.00. So let me just add that up real quickly here. We got 22.99, 1.01, 12.01, and then 48 from the oxygen. I get 84.01 grams of sodium bicarbonate per mole. So multiplying out, I've got 0.024 moles times 84.01 grams per mole, which means to two sig figs, I get 2.0 grams of sodium bicarbonate. Any questions on that problem? Okay. Moving on. The next question says that some ionic substances are able to dissolve in water while other ionic substances are not. Explain what happens to an ionic substance when it dissolves in water, and explain why some ionic substances do not dissolve in water. So that's the interaction in solutions that we had talked about, and I hadn't asked a question from that section before the exam. So you might remember that we talked about ionic substances going into solution and covalent substances going into solution, and how in one case for the ionic substances, if that's going to happen with water, the ions themselves have to pull apart. Whereas if you have something that's molecular, something that's covalent, like sugar, that molecule doesn't necessarily pull apart, or to use the more correct term, it doesn't have to dissociate in order to go into water. So if you take an ionic compound and throw it into water, those ions all have to be pulled apart from each other. So why is it that some substances do dissolve in water and some don't? Well, it's whether the attractions with the ions with each other is stronger than the attraction that the ions might have with water. And what attractions do the ions have with water? Well, you might remember me drawing a picture like this, where if I have sodium, which is a cation, a positively charged ion, floating around in solution, it's going to end up with the negative bits of oxygen turned towards the sodium, because sodium being positively charged is going to want to interact with the slight negative charges that are in the oxygens of water. If I have chlorine floating around, the opposite's going to be true. Chlorine is negatively charged, so that means the partially positive hydrogens in water are going to be turned towards the chlorine. This is what allows ionic compounds to be dissolved in water, is if they have these interactions between water and the ions. But sometimes the attraction between the ions is stronger than the attractions between water and the ions. And that would be why some ionic substances don't dissolve. So somehow or another, you needed to talk about the ions interacting with water, because that is what happens to an ionic substance once it goes into solution. Since I've brought that topic up, just to compare again to something like acetic acid. It's another covalent substance that's able to dissolve in water. And in that case, molecules of acetic acid, they're attracted to each other, but just by intermolecular forces. It's not like something like sodium chloride, where it's ions holding them together. So when acetic acid goes into water, the whole molecules may lose their attraction, but the molecules don't have bonds that break. So that's the difference between having covalent substances dissolve and ionic substances dissolved. Okay, now the next one was about gases. You were told that an ionic gas, the ideal gas law is a very simple mathematical relationship that relates several physical properties of a gas. This law is only valid when the behavior of a gas is idealized according to three principal assumptions. So you're asked to state what the three assumptions were and to explain which physical property of the gas would be affected if you didn't make that assumption. So you might remember me talking about ideal gases and talking about the three assumptions that we make. One of those assumptions is that gas molecules occupy no volume. And why does that matter? Well, because the way the gas behaves depends on the volume of the container that you have, which if the gas molecules take up room, that's taking away from the volume of the container. So the fact that gas molecules are not supposed to occupy any volume would affect volume. That's one of the physical properties of the gases. If you can remember the ideal gas law, PV equals NRT, well, it would be the V that would be affected in that equation. One of the other assumptions is that gas molecules experience no intermolecular forces. So we're pretending that they don't have any kind of attractions between each other. If it did, the way I described it in class is it would be like they're attracted to each other instead of interacting with the container, which means it would affect pressure. And then the last of the conditions is that molecules don't lose energy when they collide. And the last of the physical properties in the ideal gas law is temperature. Because if molecules lose energy, well, temperature is a measure of average kinetic energy. So if the molecules did keep losing energy, that would affect temperature. So that question was asking just what are ideal gases in general. And then we had a couple of questions that followed up asking more about gases. So the next question came straight from the lectures, because it said, imagine that you had two different containers, a rigid metal can with thick walls, which you were supposed to pretend that that can was completely indestructible, and then you had a balloon made from a very flexible rubber. So in other words, one can that could have its volume adjusted and one that couldn't. So we have the can And we have the balloon. And you were told that each of them initially is filled with 1 liter of nitrogen gas at 1 atmosphere pressure at 25 degrees Celsius. But you were told that they were both placed into a freezer that's at the same pressure for several hours, and you're asked to describe the changes in volume or pressure that would occur in the two containers and explain why that would happen. So you weren't given an exact temperature, but we can imagine the freezer's considerably colder than 25 degrees. So what's going on in both cases, initially at least, is the fact if you're dropping temperature, the molecules drop in energy. What that causes is a little bit different in each case. So in terms of the metal can, if we're imagining that it's a real, true, rigid can that's not going to be affected by pressure changes, that means it keeps its volume constant. So if the molecules are bouncing around with less energy, that means that it's less than 1 atmosphere pressure that's going to be inside that container. A way to think of it is this. If you take the ideal gas law, PV equals NRT, we had come up with another version of that gas law that lets us compare gases at different conditions. And that was P1V1 over T1 equals P2V2 over T2. So what's happening in this situation is that the volume inside that can can't change. So if you wanted to think of it mathematically, in that case, the volume stayed constant, so we have this relation between pressure and temperature. And if the temperature drops, that ends up meaning the pressure drops. You weren't asked to explain it mathematically, but I'm just trying to make that relationship for those of you who do happen to think a little bit better in terms of math. So what's going on physically is the molecules have less energy to bounce around with, but they have the same volume. So that means they're going to have a reduction in pressure. But for the balloon, the situation is a little different. The size that a balloon has depends on the balance of the pressure inside and outside the balloon. And you were told that the environment that the freezer's in stays at 1 atmosphere pressure, the pressure that the balloon was originally filled at. But same problem, that if you put the balloon in the freezer and the molecules lose their energy, well, then they're not able to fight against that outside pressure as well. And so the balloon ends up shrinking until pressure goes back up to match what the outside pressure is. So because the volume is able to change, then that's what it will do to maintain pressure. So the volume will shrink down to less than 1 liter, again because of the lower molecular motion due to low temperature, which this was exactly the discussion that we had in class. Any questions about that? Those two scenarios, the can or the balloon? Okay, then there are two problems that were mathematical in nature. So you were told that you had a rigid 5-liter container that had nitrogen gas, N2, at a pressure of 867 torr at 5 degrees Celsius. And you're asked to calculate how many moles of the gas were present. Well, that's something that comes straight from the ideal gas law. And so in the gas law, we've got 4 variables, 1 constant. R is the gas constant, and that was actually given to you in the problem because I didn't make you memorize that. So if we wanted to solve for N, the number of moles, that's equal to PV over RT. So now the pressure in that case has to be in atmospheres, because if you look at the units that were with R, that value of 0.082 is 4 units of atmosphere pressure. So you're also given that 1 atmosphere of pressure is 760 torr. So if I take the 867 and divide it by 760, that will give me the pressure in atmospheres the way that I need it. Now, volume is supposed to be in liters, which is what we were originally given. Then the gas constant is 0.0821, if you wanted to round it off a little bit. And then temperature. For any gas problem, you have to remember that temperature has to be put into Kelvin. So if we take 273 and add 5 to it, that will give us the temperature in Kelvin. So if I crunch these numbers, which give me just a moment to do that, later on, if you want to compare your answers, the pressure, if you adjusted it to atmospheres, that ended up being 1.14 atmospheres. And then putting all the other numbers in, I get right at 0.25 a mole. So 0.25 moles. The next one was another math problem, and this is exactly the type of problem where we change conditions. Because you had this gas, sulfur hexafluoride, which initially was in a balloon that had 4 liters volume at 1.01 atmosphere pressure at 25 degrees Celsius. And then you're told that you're put it in a freezer where now the pressure's dropped. It's changed to 0.950 atmospheres, and you're told it's at negative 20 degrees Celsius for its temperature, so you have to find out its new pressure. So this problem you would work by that other equation, P1V1 over T1 equals P2V2 over T2, which, if you look back at the notes, that equation is just derived from the ideal gas law itself. So all we have to do is substitute. So we already have everything in terms of atmospheres pressure. So we have 1.01 atmospheres pressure to begin with. We initially have a volume of 4 liters. And again, we had to remember to convert into Kelvin. So 25 degrees Celsius is 298 Kelvin. So now the new pressure is what we're solving for. Oh, I'm sorry, not new pressure. It's the new volume that we're solving for. The pressure, new one, is 0.950 atmospheres. So we're solving for V2. And then the new temperature is 253 Kelvin. So if I rewrite this, I get V2 is equal to 253 over 298 times 1.01 over 0.950 times 4. So let's see what that ends up being. And the answer turns out to be, to 2 sig figs, it's 3.6 liters. Okay, that ends up the gas questions. The rest of the exam was about acid-base chemistry. So first question was about defining acids and bases. So you had to define the Arrhenius versus Bronsted-Lowry definitions of an acid and a base, which were the same definitions we'd gone over class. If you remember, the Arrhenius definition is the one based on water. So an acid is something that produces H+, a base is something that produces OH-. And that's because the two combine to give us water. For the Bronsted-Lowry definition, it doesn't have anything directly to do with water. It's all about H pluses. So an acid is something that gives H plus. A base is something that accepts H plus. Now, there was one other part of the question, which was to identify a compound that is a Bronsted-Lowry base but is not an Arrhenius base. And the best example of something like that was the same one I gave in class, which is ammonia. Because this is a Bronsted-Lowry base, because it reacts with H+. So remember that under the Bronsted-Lowry definition, acids give H+, bases take them, and this one can take one. So that's why it is a Bronsted-Lowry base. But it is not an Arrhenius base, because there's no hydroxide in its formula. Now, the next question was asked to define the term neutral when describing acid-base reactions. I've only said that because you might think neutral in terms of charge. So what does neutral mean in terms of acid-base reactions? Neutral is when you have equal amounts of H plus and OH minus ions, which you could have either put that in word form, or if you wanted to make it in concentration form like this, that's fine. You could have even said the equal number of moles, because that would have been true as well. So neutral is any time you have the same amount of H plus and OH minus, which means you have the same kind of environment that you would have in water itself. The next question was asked to explain a difference between a strong acid and a weak acid. So that has to do with how much dissociation goes on, how much bond breaking goes on. So remember, a strong acid is something that completely dissociates in solution, where a weak acid barely, if at all, dissociates. You were asked to give examples of each, which there are plenty of examples of each of these that I had given in class. So some examples of strong acids include hydrochloric acid, HCl, sulfuric acid, H2SO4, nitric acid, HNO3. I think those were the main examples I had given in class. For weak acids, there were a couple of different ones. One was acetic acid. That's the main one that we had talked about in class. Although I think as some of you had also given HF, hydrofluoric acid, an example of a substance that's quite hazardous, even though it's technically classified as a weak acid. Two more questions. The next one was to write a chemical equation that shows the neutralization of hydrochloric acid with sodium hydroxide. So all you had to do was to write out a reaction equation. Now, I didn't tell you to put in state symbols. I'm going to do it just to be complete about it. So hydrochloric acid, when we put it in water, is an aqueous solution. So if you wanted to be complete about it, you put the AQ symbol in. Sodium hydroxide, same thing. That if we're reacting it as a solution, it would be aqueous. And then we're going to get two products. One of them is sodium chloride, which would also be a solution. And then the leftover, if we take the hydrogen from hydrochloric acid, the hydroxide from sodium hydroxide, we get water. So again, since I didn't ask for them, you didn't have to put the state symbols in, but this is a little more complete way of writing it out. You are then asked to define the term neutralized when describing acid-base reactions. So neutralized is when moles acid equals the number of moles of base. And then final question was about pH. So you were told that pH is a way of measuring how much H plus we have in solution. So you're asked to state the mathematical definition. Well, pH is the negative log of the H plus concentration. If you remembered it, you might remember that I wrote the number 10 below the log just to distinguish that from the natural log function that you have on your calculator. As long as you wrote negative log, if you didn't put the 10 in, that's okay. Then you were asked to calculate the pH for a solution that had a particular concentration. So you just used the expression that you wrote out. You were asked to calculate the pH for a solution that had a concentration of 1.75 times 10 to the negative 4. So 1.5 times 10 to the negative 4. If I plug that in and then take the negative log of it, I get 3.76. Any questions at all over exam material? Okay, so we still need to discuss, but given that we have break time coming up soon, let me switch over to talking about the topics that are going to be on the quiz this upcoming Thursday. So the main topics on the quiz are going to be from the electrochemistry chapter, which is the chapter previous to what we're doing now. So that is the chapter on oxidation and reduction. So first of all, you do need to know what is oxidation and what is reduction. So oxidation is any time that you lose electrons. Reduction is any time that you gain electrons. Now, there's some alternate definitions that your text runs through, or it's not an alternate definitions. It just mentions that other things can happen in these oxidation and reduction processes. So if you add hydrogen to a molecule, that is usually associated with reduction. If you're adding oxygen to a molecule, that is usually associated with oxidation. But those are not the best definitions for what oxidation and reduction are. Let me just show you this picture that's in your text so that if you go back and review later, you can see where I'm pulling from. So the text gives you an idea that these different things happen, but it's not true for all oxidation or reduction processes. Not all oxidations involve oxygen. Not all reductions involve hydrogen. So the best definition for oxidation and reduction has to do with what happens to electrons. So oxidation is when you lose electrons. Reduction is when you gain electrons. You should know some very common examples of oxidizing agents or oxidizers and reducing agents, or reducers. And there's one of each that's very easy to remember if you can just remember the periodic table. Because sodium, metal, is right on the left-hand side of the periodic table. We know that sodium wants to lose electrons, which means sodium's a good reducing agent. It's able to provide electrons. On the other side of the periodic table, fluorine, most electronegative element there is. Fluorine wants to gain electrons to become an octet, so fluorine is a good example of an oxidizing agent because it wants to take electrons from something else. Now, we did talk about oxidation states. And we went over a couple of examples of how to determine the oxidation state for each element that's in a compound. So remember, there are some rules that went along with that, that if you have an element that hasn't reacted, it automatically has an oxidation state of zero because it hasn't gained or lost anything yet. If you have an ion that it's a single atom, so monatomic ion, The charge is the same as the oxidation state. You're told that hydrogen's normally plus one, oxygen's normally negative two, and you can use all of those rules plus one last one to solve most problems. The last rule is that if you add all the oxidation states up, that has to be the same as the overall formal charge. So I think I remember us doing chromate or dichromate, something like that, in lecture, applying the rules and coming up with the oxidation states. The reason you need to be able to come up with oxidation states is if I gave you an equation, you need to be able to look at that equation, figure out what is gaining electrons, what is losing electrons. And maybe after the break, we can do another one of those for practice if you all would like to do another one of those again. So that's why you need to know oxidation states to figure out what is oxidized, what is reduced. The other main topic that we discussed from the chapter was about electrochemical cells. And I'll just draw a mini picture of it to remind you what that discussion was. What we talked about was a pair of solutions, each of which had an electrode in it. So along with electrochemical cells, you need to know what the anode and cathode is. Those electrodes, that's the general term, are what could be the two halves of a battery. So one of those would have electrons that are coming into the electrode. That would be the cathode, where reduction's occurring. And then the other one is taking in electrons, because that's where oxidation's occurring. Wait, I just said that backwards. I'm sorry. The one where oxidation is occurring, that's oxidation of what the metal is. So I'm sorry, that's the one that's got electrons being released by the metal. And the other one that's pulling in electrons is the one where reduction's occurring, because it's pulling in those electrons, and that would be the cathode. There's this thing that connects the two solutions, though, called the salt bridge. And remember, what that is for is that if you only have electrons being lost on one side, then you're generating positive charge, more and more positive charge, and you can't have a container that just has positive charge like that. So the salt bridge helps to provide anions in that case to balance out charge. Same thing would go on the other side. Whichever side has reduction going on, then you would end up with negative charge in solution, which the salt bridge would provide the cations to balance that out. The version in your textbook is very slightly different than what we saw in lab, because it puts the two solutions together in one container. The container itself has the counter ions, those ions of opposite charge, that are able to balance out. So instead of having two separate beakers like the drawing I had in class, it combines it all into one. But otherwise, it's exactly the same example that I had given in class, specifically where we have copper and copper sulfate on one side, or copper plus two ions on one side, and then silver metal and silver ions on the other. Now, most of the rest of the chapter we ended up skipping, which at some point, if we want to, we can come back and talk about the different types of batteries that are mentioned in the chapter. And after the quiz, I should come back and mention something about electrolysis. But we hadn't talked about those yet, so it's only these topics up through section 8.3 that are going to be on the quiz. That's it from the electrochemistry chapter. And so the last thing left is the organic chemistry chapter, which we're not done with yet, and so not all of the chapter is going to be on the quiz. We had talked about some essential terminology. So, for example, what hydrocarbons are. And we talked about saturated versus unsaturated hydrocarbons, which the difference there is saturated only has single bonds in it, and unsaturated has double or triple bonds in it. I think for the quiz, I will not have you I'll not have you explicitly be able to interpret line structures. So I'll write out all structures that you need more fully. By the time of the test, though, where you've had more chance to practice, more chance to read the chapter, at that point I would expect that you'd be able to handle line structures better. Now, some other terminology that we got. We did talk about what isomers are. And so you need to be able to talk in general about what isomers are, not necessarily the specific types of isomers that we covered. For the exam, then I might get more specific. And if you might remember, there were two types of isomers that were mentioned in your text. One is where you simply have atoms hooked up differently to each other. So if I did use line structures just to save space, one example is in butane, where you can have the atoms in butane, the carbons, all lined up in a row, or you can have them in this sort of T-shaped structure. So they have the same number of atoms, but they have different structures. That's one form of isomer. Another form of isomer had to do with double bonds. And that's because the double bond in an alkene cannot change its geometric format, not without reacting. So anything attached to that double bond is permanently locked into a certain position. And after the break, I'm going to talk a little bit about bonding, which it won't be part of the quiz or the exam, but I just want to have you get a better understanding of why the molecules have the shapes they do. Why is it that double bonds can't change the geometric configuration? So these are the two forms of isomers mentioned in your text. The third form I talked about in class was what's known as a stereoisomer, where it has to do with its 3D structure. For the quiz, as long as you can discuss any kind of isomer, for right now, that's going to be good enough. So then, other than that, we started going through different forms of functional groups. And you would need to be able to just be able to identify what the functional groups are that we've covered so far. So in hydrocarbons, we have alkanes, alkenes, and alkynes, which are compounds with single bonds, double bonds, or triple bonds, but nothing but carbon or hydrogen. So they're pure hydrocarbons, but the differences are which type of bonds do they have. We then started to get through some of the other functional groups. Specifically, we went through alcohols, ether, aldehydes, and ketones. So an alcohol is something that has an OH group on it. An ether is something where it's got an oxygen, but it has carbons on either side. In other words, it does not have a hydrogen on it. Aldehydes and ketones, those are very similar, but an aldehyde is something that does have a hydrogen on a carbon-oxygen double bond. And a ketone is something that does not have a hydrogen on that carbon-oxygen double bond. So we've got seven functional groups. I'll talk about more after the break, but those new groups we talk about today are not going to be on the quiz. So this is the list of quiz material. Did anybody have any questions about it, clarifications about it? Then why don't we go ahead and take our break, and we'll talk more about organic chemistry when we come back. What I'm going to talk about for a little bit now is material that's not going to be on any quiz or exam, but it's material about bonding, because there's the molecule benzene that's mentioned in your text, and benzene's a very special behaving organic molecule that's really difficult to communicate why it's special unless you know something about bonding. And we've talked about single bonds, double bonds, and triple bonds, but because it is a deeper subject, the text hasn't gotten into really at all what the difference between single and double and triple bonds is. So the reason it's difficult to discuss it is because it is related to orbitals, which you learned only a little bit about orbitals back when we were talking about atomic structure and electron configuration. And so let me just remind you a little bit about where the orbitals come from. Orbitals come from the fact that electrons don't act just like particles. They also have a wave behavior to them, which is one of the foundations of quantum mechanics, if you've ever heard that phrase before. And so electrons don't actually travel in nice circular paths around the atom like simpler pictures of the atom would tell us. They have the ability to be spread out across an atom in these different regions that are called orbitals. And you might remember back when we talked about atomic structure, you might have seen the picture of an S orbital and a P orbital, which an S orbital is a spherical shape that's centered right around the nucleus. A P orbital is another shape that has a dumbbell shape to it, with, again, the nucleus being right at the center of that. And these shapes can be derived from equations that are used to describe the wave behavior of an electron. So the term for that is a wave function. That's a function that describes this wave behavior of an electron. These atomic orbitals have their shapes based on the fact that there's exactly one nucleus in an atom. And in fact, if we looked at other shapes of orbitals, there are more complicated shapes, but they all end up being symmetric around the nucleus. When we start moving to molecules, where there are electrons that can interact with multiple nuclei, the orbitals change shapes themselves. And so there's a more complicated picture of how the orbitals are developed on a molecule. I'm not going to try to explain that process of where it comes from because you really need more background, but I can show you the end result because it helps us get to the point where you can at least see a picture of a single bond, a double bond, or a triple bond. And so here's what the situation in a molecule like methane is like. Methane is carbon with four hydrogens attached, and that means that it's a completely symmetric molecule. All the bonds that carbon has are equivalent with each other. And there's a set of orbitals that look something like a distorted P orbital. So one half the orbital is larger in shape, the other one is really tiny in shape. And in fact, to make the picture even simpler, I'm going to leave out that little tail end, the small part of the orbital. So in a molecule like methane, what you end up with is four orbitals that happen to have that same tetrahedral arrangement as the molecule itself. And those orbitals, again, those represent the spaces that electrons can travel in. When that's just coming off of carbon itself. Then we have the hydrogens, which act like S orbitals. And what you have is when the orbitals from carbon and hydrogen overlap, there's a direct head-to-head connection. And that type of connection is known as a sigma bond. The sigma is Greek letter S, which that's related to the S orbital. I think that's where it got its name originally. So the sigma bond is the single connection that can happen between any two orbitals that point head-to-head to each other. And in any organic molecule where you have single bonds, that's the type of bond that we have. So now what happens in something that has a double bond in it? So that ends up having a different kind of orbital arrangement. So if I look at the molecule C2H4, that's the simplest organic molecule that has a double bond in it. What we end up with is this. The carbons end up having orbitals that adopt a trigonal planar shape. You might remember back when we were doing Lewis structures, we talked about molecular shapes. Well, these two carbons both end up trigonal in their geometry, and you can see that the two carbons are touching end to end together. So that's exactly that sigma bond that I was talking about earlier. And then we have hydrogens that are also attached by sigma bonds. But in a molecule like this, there ends up being a p orbital that's left over as well. And those p orbitals may not be directly pointed at each other, but they end up close enough to each other that they can undergo this side-by-side kind of overlap. Now, the p orbital is split into two halves. So up above here where I show one line showing that overlap, that's just half of an orbital overlapping with another half of the orbital. So that one line is just half a bond. It's the two halves working together that make up a new bond. That type of bond is called a pi bond. Pi being the Greek letter for P. Again, probably that comes from the name of the P orbital. So a double bond is the fact that there are two of these different types of orbital overlaps happening within two atoms. You have a sigma bond, which is the head-to-head overlap, and then you have this side-by-side overlap, which makes the second bond in a double bond. The fact that there's an overlap both above and below the direction in between the two atoms is exactly why that double bond is locked in geometry. Because if you were to try to grab one side of the molecule and spin it, it's connected in really three different places, if you wanted to think about it that way, between, above, and below. So if you try to twist one side of the molecule, the other side of the molecule is going to automatically twist with it. So that double bond locks in the geometry, and then that's why we end up with those two types of isomers that alkenes have, cis and trans. Now, a triple bond is even a slight bit more complicated. The simplest triple-bonded organic molecule is acetylene, which you find in acetylene torches. And in this case, you have orbitals coming from carbon that are in a linear arrangement. And then you have two sets of p orbitals. One set, if we put it in the plane of the paper like what I've done here, they'll be parallel with each other, but then there's one more set that's perpendicular to the plane of the paper. Well, both of those are able to overlap with each other, both of those sets of orbitals. So in a triple bond, which is what this is, you have the sigma bond that's in the middle where the orbitals between carbons are directly touching, and then you have these other orbitals that are undergoing this side-by-side overlap. There's something in quantum mechanics which is known as the Pauli exclusion principle. And what that says is that no two electrons can occupy exactly the same space. There's only one exception, which has to do with how the electrons are effectively spinning around in space. So even when you have a pair of electrons which have opposite spin, if they fill up an orbital, you can't have any other electrons that fill that exact same space. So that's why a double bond is not just a connection of two pairs directly between the atoms. You can have one pair that's directly between, but then the other pair can't be in exactly the same space. So that's why it ends up this being this pi bond that provides the second connection. Same thing going on in a triple bond. once you have one pi bond going on, you can't have another pair occupy that exact same space. So then that's what leads to another pi bond that's at 90 degrees, that's perpendicular to the original one. So you have three different types of overlap, which what leads to the triple bond. Now, it's the fact that the electrons are held not directly in between the atoms, but above and below, that also makes those double bonds more reactive. The pi portion of the double bond is easier to break because the electrons aren't held quite as tightly together. So since I've shown you this much, I can talk about the molecule benzene. Benzene, if I write it out in a line structure format, looks like either one of the two molecules I've drawn here. Of course, there's a third molecule that I have a very minor story to tell. When I was a organic chemistry student, I happened to go to engineering office one day, and the guy said, "Oh, you're a chemistry major, huh? Tell me what this molecule is." Because this is benzene, and then this one would be Mercedes benzene, which if you look at the shape inside there. Listen, chemistry jokes are full of are very few and far between. I have to tell little bits of humor where I get them. There's only really one good chemistry joke. Did I already waste that in here? Did I already tell it? Oh, so now you can really groan at this one then. Two atoms were walking down the road one day, and one atom turns to the other and says, "You know, I think I just lost an electron." And the second atom turns to the first and says, "Are you sure?" And the first one says, "Yeah, I'm positive." Okay, if you even chuckle a little bit, that means you learned enough chemistry to know that something's positive when it loses an electron. I'm telling you, there's not that many jokes, but I did want to get a reaction out of you. I won't quit my day job, don't worry. So back to real benzene, you notice that I can write it one of two ways, and it looks like I just rotated it around on paper. The real story is this. If I draw out what benzene really looks like, it's got six carbons in it that are all in a circle, and they all end up with this trigonal planar arrangement of orbitals. And when they have that arrangement, it turns out each one ends up with a p orbital on it as well. And you saw earlier that I connected the p orbitals to make a double bond. The question would be, well, if I had one p orbital, is it going to overlap with the atom that's to the left of it, or is it going to overlap with the atom that's to the right of it? And the answer ends up being yes. That all of those atoms can overlap with each other. You create what's called a delocalized system. So in fact, what these two structures are that I wrote up above, they are resonance structures, which you might remember resonance coming up back when we did Lewis dot structures. It's because these electrons are shared all the way across the molecule that molecules like benzene have really special reactivity. So I know this is a highly simplified picture of bonding still, but at least it gives you some pictures to look at to try to understand, well, what does a single bond look like? What does a double bond look like? What does a triple bond look like? And in any single bond, it's a connection directly between the atoms. In any double bond, there's two connections, but the second is like a sandwich connection. And again, the main point I wanted to make about that is that's why double bonds are locked into a particular geometry. You can't rotate the one side independent of the other. Whereas if you're in a single bond, because there's only that one connection, then that's why single bonds are able to twist around. So that's a little bit about bonding. Now, back to organic chemistry. I wanted to try to come up with some example where you'd have some chance of appreciating why do we worry about functional groups. Like, what is it about functional groups that can make molecules special? So again, this is outside of the textbook, but this is the best example I could think of, which is to talk about how electrical signals are communicated in nerve cells. Does anybody actually know anything about how your nerve cells work? Yeah, tell me a little bit about it. Yes.
And through those gaps are passed chemicals that act as signal transmission.
And if I really highly simplify the drawing, like imagine that I've got two nerve cells here, which are much more complicated in their structure than what I'm drawing, what you just described was the synapse, the space that's in between two different nerve cells. And you said there's these chemical messengers that are sent back and forth. Those are known as neurotransmitters. So what ends up happening is that one of the nerve cells can release a chemical agent that's in the gap in between the nerve cells. And that chemical agent's going to have a certain shape to it. On the other side, you have what are known as receptor sites. And those receptor sites will have a specific shape that is designed to fit the molecule that's being transmitted across. And so if you know this much about nerve cells, do you know how the electrical signals themselves are generated within a cell? So what ends up happening is in the cell themselves, there are channels which allow sodium ions or potassium ions, different types of ions, to flow in or out of the cell. And if you have an imbalance that's generated, like if sodium ions flow just one direction, you end up with an imbalance of charge, which is what can lead to the generation of a nerve signal. So with just that much of the story right there, then I can explain why things like the Novocaine that you get at the dentist office work the way it does. Because when you get an injection like that, what it's doing is it's blocking off those sodium channels. It's preventing ion flow from happening. Well, if you prevent ion flow from happening, you're not generating the electrical signal, so there is no nerve impulse. Of course, eventually the body has a way of clearing out those sodium channels, which is why after you get the injection, eventually it wears off. And you can kind of feel that tingling process as the cell resets itself. So there are chemical agents that could be used just to block even the action of a nerve cell. But then I wanted to focus on these neurotransmitters themselves. The body actually has quite a number of different neurotransmitter systems that respond to different classes of chemicals. So one chemical that you've probably never heard of before is acetylcholine. There's the acetylcholine neurotransmitter system, which is divided into two subclasses. One of the subclasses, one of the major components that can act like a neurotransmitter, is nicotine. That's why, I don't know if you've ever known anybody that's tried to give up smoking before, but generally it's not the most pleasant experience to be the person around the person that's giving up smoking. Because there's the sociological aspect of it, of course, but there's the fact that if they give up smoking, that the body's gotten used to this neurotransmitter level, that once you take it away, the body says, I want that back. It's a form of withdrawal. So, and that's because that nicotine is acting as one of these chemical agents. Now, there are several different other systems in the body as well. One of them is the dopamine system, which is partly related to the fight or flight instinct, partly related to mood to some degrees. And I have a handout that shows a series of chemicals here that all can interact with that dopa system. So some of these you might recognize from street drugs like amphetamine or methamphetamine. So there's the structure of meth, that second chemical in. That, if you look at those first two structures, they're very similar to ephedrine, which is related to adrenaline. And you can see that the difference between amphetamine itself versus methamphetamine is just one little carbon group that's put at the end there. I don't know if you remember me talking very briefly about naming of organic molecules, but a one carbon unit is called methyl. Well, that's where the meth and methamphetamine comes in, the fact that you've just got one little carbon that's put on there. You put an alcohol group on it, and that turns it into ephedrine. One of the groups we haven't talked about yet, the ester group. If you put that on instead, then that turns it into Ritalin, which some of you might know is a drug that's used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So this same chemical that's used to treat that disorder, if you look at the structure of it, it's nearly identical to all these other compounds, or very similar, in fact, in structure to this MDMA, which is the active component in ecstasy. As another example, serotonin. The serotonin neurotransmitter system is one that's heavily involved in mood regulation and in conceptualization of the self. So there's a selection of molecules here that I put in this worksheet that show 5-HT, there's a letter I think missing there, but that's serotonin. That's the main neurotransmitter agent itself. And you can see that that's related to melatonin, also related to tryptophan. If you've ever heard stories that if you eat a big turkey dinner that that makes you sleepy because there's this stuff tryptophan in it, that ends up not really being true. It's just you're going through massive food coma because in order to get enough tryptophan, I forget how many turkeys it is that you have to eat, but so many that's not really what's going on. But this compound tryptophan, if you look at the ring structure here and compare it to serotonin, it is very similar. Of course, both of those are very similar to these other two chemicals down here at the bottom. LSD, which if you've never heard of before, it's colloquially called acid. And if you look at the two ring structure here that's in tryptophan or serotonin, and then count over to the nitrogen there, you have that same two ring structure here in LSD, which is why it has the effect that it does, because it sits in the same neurotransmitter site as these other chemicals do. Or you might have heard about in the news lately that Denver and I think Oakland now is considering decriminalizing what are known as magic mushrooms. Well, the main component in that, if you compare that to serotonin, it's not identical, but it's awfully close. And that's exactly the point of why it has the biological effect that it does, that it sits in the same receptor sites. The only difference between these molecules are really the functional groups. That's the point of me showing them. That in serotonin, you have an alcohol group, the OH group, that's missing in tryptophan. It's replaced by a phosphoric acid type group in psilocybin. And then the nitrogen, that's a group that we haven't talked about yet, known as an amine. In some of these molecules, the nitrogen is all by its own. In some of the molecules, it has methyl groups on them. Just small changes in functional groups cause huge changes in the way that the molecules behave. I've got one last example of that, and then we'll move on to something else. Opioids. You've heard probably a lot about opioid crisis. That's because the opioid is another neurotransmitter system that mitigates pain. It's an extremely active system, and these compounds have very high potential for addiction because it's directly interacting with your neurotransmitter systems. The reason I wanted to show you these is because you might have been prescribed codeine before if you've had your wisdom teeth out or something like that, and it's a really complex structure. But if you look at the central part of that structure, where you've got these rings that are all connected to each other, that's exactly the same structure that you have in morphine, which is a powerful painkiller that you might get in the hospital, or heroin, which is a really nasty drug because of its addictive potential. In fact, technically, if you've had morphine before, you've had the same effect as what happens from heroin. because heroin has what are known as ester groups on it. That's one of the groups that we'll talk about after we're done with this handout. Those ester groups fall off when they cross over into the brain, and they turn into morphine. So really, the two compounds are just cousins of each other. And they both happen to be directly related to codeine, which only difference between codeine and these other two is, again, that you're changing functional groups. It's been altered to have a functional group that makes it a little bit less reactive, which is why it's not quite as effective, but also not quite as addictive, which is why they make the codeine drugs that they give for a moderate amount of pain. So I could talk more about this subject, but I just wanted to give you some examples of molecules, again, just to show that all these differences in chemistry happen just between functional groups. Now, if I've still got it on here, let me see if I still have this handout. This I wanted to show you just to have an example of something outside of the realm of drugs. These are all different compounds that are isolated from different plant sources. And so I don't know if you can read from where you're sitting, but like the second row here, this list of chemicals are main ones that come out of bay leaves versus pine versus mint versus citrus versus cypress trees. You notice that they all have the same essential kind of shape to them. It's just the position of their functional groups, in this case alkenes, are in slightly different places. So the way that the nose perceives scent is the way that molecules fit in to receptor sites on the nose. And so by changing around just the position of the functional groups a little bit, that's how we get all these different smells that come from different plants. Even if we go on to slightly more complicated molecules, just to show you a selection here. Fennel versus camphor versus marigold versus peppermint versus lemongrass. They're all very similar related in terms of their carbon structure. It's just that they have different functional groups on them. So like you look up over here for lemongrass, it's got an aldehyde functional group, carbonyl here with a hydrogen hanging off of it. If you close up the ring and turn it into a ketone instead, then we get the smell that peppermint has. If you open it back up but keep the ketone, then that's how we get the smell of marigolds. So all these are very related substances, just with changes in functional groups. All right, so now let's move back to the notes. So I don't have a heck of a lot of time left, but I just wanted to do some discussion to help give a little bit more flavor to this chapter. So now two other functional groups I would like to talk about. One functional group you've already been introduced to, and that's the carboxylic acid. So a carboxylic acid in line structure form always has this set of atoms in it, which, in case you haven't had a chance to practice at all with line structures, let me write this out in complete form. So this R, I hadn't used that before, but it's used very commonly in organic chemistry. And it's kind of like the X in mathematics. It's just a variable name. So R means you can have some other structure, some larger molecule that this COOH is attached to. So the COOH is what makes it a carboxylic acid. And there's plenty of examples of naturally occurring carboxylic acids. There's acetic acid, which is the one that's in vinegar. The simplest carboxylic acid is a one carbon acid known as formic acid. That name comes from the Latin for ant, which is formica, And that's because in the stinging venom of some ants, part of what has that stinging is this formic acid itself. So structurally, it's very related to acetic acid. If you look at olive oil, it's a much larger molecule, I know, but this is oleic acid, one of the major constituents of olive oil. It is a large-chain carboxylic acid, which, why am I showing you a picture like that? To very quickly tell you a story about soap. Do you all have any concept of how soaps work? Okay, so let me explain that really quickly. If you take a compound like oleic acid, and if you react it with something like sodium hydroxide, you make a carboxylic acid salt, because the carboxylic acid is an acid. It's able to provide a proton. So hydroxide can pull the proton off the end of this molecule, making that end of the molecule ionic. So what you end up with is a very long portion of the molecule that's very nonpolar. Why is it nonpolar? Because even if it's not completely symmetric, all these carbons here, except for the middle two, are tetrahedral in geometry. And carbon-hydrogen bonds are not that much different from carbon-carbon bonds. And so in these tetrahedrons, you mostly have the polarity cancel out. So in a long carbon chain like this, that long carbon chain ends up being very nonpolar, which means it's not soluble in the water. We would know that because if you take olive oil and try to put it in water, it just makes a separate layer. But when you make a salt out of it like this, you then end up with a very small portion of the molecule that is quite polar because it's ionic. And so you get a molecule that's got this split behavior to it. And what happens is if you start adding small amounts of this type of molecule to water, it will automatically arrange into a geometric pattern, where if I simplify the structure and write these polar groups as little circles and then the organic bits as tails, what will happen is that the molecules will automatically draw themselves into different shapes. And so one type of shape that you might have heard of in your biology class is something known as a micelle. It's a spherical shape that you get just from the molecules arranging themselves based off the fact that these ionic bits want to be surrounded by water. So they're all facing outwards to water, where all the organic bits want to face into the inside because they are more compatible with themselves. Now, if you ever have had any kind of biology class, if you take a molecule that's long like oleic acid, but instead of a carbon at the end here, we have a phosphorus, then you end up with molecules that end up forming these other kinds of structures where they form layers instead. And the buzzword in biology is phospholipid bilayer. Phospho because of phosphorus. Lipid means something that's fat-soluble, not water-soluble. And bilayer from the fact that it forms these layers. In other words, it's the same type of formation that might be on the surface of a cell, where these molecules just automatically arrange themselves in this manner. So how does this have anything to do with the story of soap? Well, soap forms micelles like this. Soap's got exactly the same kind of split behavior type of structure, where most of it is very nonpolar, part of it it's polar. So let's say you've cooked that nice greasy dish and then you put soap into the sink afterwards. The organic parts of the soap will surround bits of fat, encapsulate them in these little spherical things called micelles. The micelles on the surface are compatible with water, and so the micelles will float through water carrying the fat away with them, and that's how soaps work. Soaps historically were produced by taking vegetable or animal fat that has lots of these long carboxylic acids. You expose them to lye, which is a really basic substance that turns those acids into these kinds of salts, and that's how you get soap. So soaps, many soaps are derivatives of carboxylic acid. So if you go home, I remember a student came to class once. This will seem like a side story, but it's related. Student came to class and she said to me, "Dr. Gray, I'm so upset at you." I thought, uh-oh, here it comes. It's that last quiz or that last exam that she's going to unload on me about. And what she said was, "I went to the grocery store the other day with my friends and I picked up a shampoo bottle and I could read it." And the reason was she was upset is she needed a better group of friends. The group of friends were not happy with the fact that she could understand chemistry. And I told her, that's not a bad thing to actually know something. You realize that. But it was just kind of funny because she had listened enough in lecture where she could turn over the back of a shampoo bottle and actually understand what some of the stuff was on it. So if you go home and take the back of a shampoo bottle and you see words like palmitate or stearate or myristate, these are all long chain molecules that do exactly what I'm describing here, that they're mostly nonpolar with polar bits, which is why they're in your shampoo bottles. So that's a story that came just from talking about carboxylic acids. The last functional group that I wanted to introduce today is the ester. So an ester is where you take a carboxylic acid and you replace the hydrogen that would normally be in the acid position with some other carbon group. And even as your text mentioned, your text has a little table in it that shows a variety of small esters and how they're related to common fragrances. If you haven't had a chance to get to that point in the chapter, let me just flash it up here so you know where it is, what I'm talking about. So it gives you the written out, the full structures for a variety of esters to understand how to read this. You see there's the COO in the middle of each of these molecules. So the carbon that's on the left-hand side, that's the one that's part of this ester group, the one that's got the double bond. So that carbon has a double bond to the first oxygen, single bond to the next oxygen. And you can see the variety: apple, pineapple, pear, banana, apricot, orange, rum, all these different flavors or fragrances that come from all these small type of esters. So the one of the handouts I was flashing up there earlier related to plant-based products, many of those are also esters. So a large number of food additives turn out to be esters. A large number of the components in just perfumes end up being esters. And the last story I have the time to be able to tell is about one of our biological enemies, fat, which is this. If you take glycerol is a compound that has three carbons in it, and each carbon has an alcohol group on it. If you combine that glycerol and make esters, really long chain esters, then this is what's called a triglyceride, which is otherwise known as a fat molecule. So different kinds of fats have these really long chain carboxylic acids that have been reacted with glycerol to form esters. And it's some of these types of fats that form the surfaces of cell membranes. If you replace one of these long chains with a phosphor group, that's what ends up with the phosphorus-containing compounds that can make cell membranes. And then again, we talked a little bit about beneficial or bad fats in class the other day. If these triglycerides have double bonds in them, that makes them more reactable, more capable of the body chewing them up and breaking them into smaller units. But if you have saturated fats, that makes them less reactive, which is why they end up more harmful. So that's what a triglyceride is. It's another example of an ester.